Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. It's a great pleasure to speak to Holly Fretwell with her colleague Jonathan Wood, publishing Fix America's Forests, Reforms to Restore National Forests and Tackle the Wildfire Crisis. We've touched on these 8 recommendations in part, but I want to go through them for Holly to explain more completely. Holly, you encourage collaboration. We've just talked about that, the Good Neighbor Act. Avoiding analysis paralysis. I like that. What does it mean, Holly?
Well, analysis paralysis is one of those terms, and like the Gordian knot that our former chief of the Forest Service, several of them have come up with, in the sense of there are so many layered regulations that overlap each other that make it really difficult to get anything done on the ground. We have the NEPA, we have the Clean Air Act, we have the Endangered Species Act, we have the National Forest Management Act, we have the Wilderness Act. All these different laws have to be abided by the agency, and by the time you get done trying to work your way through that, you're kind of tied in a knot, and that's where the Gordian knot comes from. But there are things that we can do to reduce that. And I think if you take all of our recommendations and you sum them up, what we're trying to say is, you know what, we really just need to lower the transaction costs so that we can actually get something done on the ground. And it's going to take some collaborative groups. It's going to take some public-private partnerships. And it's going to take the ability for the Forest Service to have more flexibility with their contracts so that they can be longer, so that they can meet the time that is necessary to get some investment in the infrastructure that we need in order to add some value to some of these small diameter products.
We've spoken of the litigation and the, what you'd have to say, odd combination of having a lot of forests and having a lot of litigation as compared to the southeast of the United States, which has wonderful, rich forests, but very little litigation. It's a puzzle we're not going to solve here. However, when it comes to the EPA or NEPA, the Clean Air Act and water, Holly, do we need larger and longer-term exclusions? Did I understand that word correctly?
Yeah, we have what's called categorical exclusions, which are actually under the National Environmental Policy Act, and they allow for the Forest Service or other federal agencies to actually do some projects that don't have big environmental impacts or that are not seen to have environmental impacts, but actually get them done without going through this long, drawn-out NEPA process. And what we would like to see is just slightly larger categorical exclusions, something that makes sense at the scale of wildfire. The recent NEPA planning rules, unfortunately, did not expand what forest restoration can do under categorical exclusions, and we feel like that's really, really necessary in order to get some of this stuff done and to get it done at the pace and scale that we need in order to protect some of our forests and those people living nearby and far, far away when we're thinking about the air.
The Endangered Species Act is keen on preserving what they understand of the species in the area. But it occurs to me that if you're going to do a controlled burn, you have to go through the Endangered Species Act. That's illogical because, of course, the species are going to be damaged with the burn. How can you help it? But you're trying to save the whole ecosystem, not just one part of it.
That's right, and that's one of the other things that we really want people to start considering, both at the legal side of things and just when we're looking at some of these planning and these processes, and that is if we don't do anything, then we're likely to see the burn, and the burn is going to be much more damaging for the wildlife, for the water, for the air, for people living in the region. So let's start to think about, well, we might have some environmental damage if we do this restoration, but in the long run, that damage is going to be much, much less and have a much smaller impact than if we just allow this thing to burn down.
Scale up partnerships with private enterprise and with the states. I wonder, Holly, if you showed pictures to people wandering around, you showed them a picture of a forest where you can throw a frisbee from one tree to another, and then a forest where that's impossible. And I think they'd pick the one where you can't throw the frisbee as the healthy one, wouldn't they? They wouldn't understand frisbee throwing in forests.
I think that's right, and it's funny, John, because 20 years ago, we actually did a picture book sort of forests and healthy forests and non-healthy forests and what they look like, and when we started doing that, I didn't get it, right? I'm like, no, that's the healthy forest. They're like, no, that's the non-healthy forest. That's the overly dense forest. That's the one that's dying and that has increased mortality. So I had to train myself. And so for the past 20 years, we've been looking at these ideas, and more people are beginning to understand what that healthy forest looks like. And that's helpful. I think we also need to be a little bit careful about using the term healthy forest and what that means, because again, we as humans define what healthy is and what we want from our forest, and we don't all always agree on that. So when I'm talking about a healthy forest, I'm thinking about a forest that we're increasing the resiliency of that forest. We're doing some restoration so we have good wildlife habitat, we have good recreation opportunity, and we've really reduced the risk of a severe wildfire.
Longer term contracts. You mentioned that several times during the course of the presentation here. What do you mean by longer term? Why are they limited now for any of these services?
Well, the Forest Service has a number of different types of contracts and negotiations and contractual arrangements that they can get into to both, you know, provide ecosystem services and different types of services, you know, including, you know, putting culverts and roads in, selling timber, et cetera. And typically they are restricted to, 3, 5, 10 years. We have a few stewardship contracts that now can actually go up to 20 years if we're looking at restoration type contracts. But oftentimes that's still a little bit too short if we're actually asking somebody to invest in some infrastructure. If we need a processing plant or a mill in a region, that's millions and millions of dollars that's going to be paid back or get the return on that investment over 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So the Forest Service only being able to negotiate in these shorter term contracts is limiting the ability of some of these private investors to be willing to actually invest. So what we would like to see is the Forest Service to be able to provide a little more certainty that they're actually going to see this restoration project through and that they're going to continue to provide some of the forest products and the stuff that's within the forest that needs to be removed over a longer period of time so that the private sector is willing to invest in this. And it doesn't have to be a guarantee that they're going to get it for the next 20 years, but if the Forest Service is able to actually be in a contractual arrangement and cost share for that time period, then it provides a little bit more certainty and reduces the risk for the private sector. So it increases the willingness of the private sector to invest in some of the infrastructure that we need to add value to some of the small diameter materials that need to be pulled out of the forest.
Wood. Everybody wants wood. The puzzle I run into in Holly's presentation is there's limitations on shipping wood overseas. Where's that from? Whose good idea was the idea you can't sell wood to Europe?
We actually have had bans on wood since way back into the 1960s, and that's a ban on export logs. And if you go back even to the day when I was doing my master's thesis many years ago, we saw that the state of Washington was banning export logs to Japan because the idea was that we would create more jobs by producing by adding value to those products here, by processing it into 2x4s and other things here in the United States rather than shipping those raw logs overseas. One of the things that we actually saw, though, was that Japan and other countries oftentimes have different metrics for the types of logs that they want. They're different sizes than our mills are set up to cut. So instead of providing us more jobs here, we actually just lost the sales. And those types of export restrictions continue to this day. And again, it's just sort of that long restriction that has some special interest group that says, no, we shouldn't be selling these logs. But at the end of the day, if the market overseas is better than the market here, and what we're trying to do is get this stuff out and get a return on it, then we ought to just open those markets up and allow them to sell. In today's world, it seems like we don't have quite enough supply here in the United States of 2x4s and whatnot, building products. So we might actually see better value right here, but why not allow that competition so that we can actually get the highest value from those logs?
You need private partnership. Won't you attract milling capacity? You say it's uneven in the country, milling capacity. Won't you attract it if you permit those mills to sell overseas unfinished logs? Doesn't that help everybody, the forest and the profit?
Absolutely. You know, trade is a win-win deal, and we are all for voluntary trade and really believe that we should get rid of some of those export restrictions so that we allow for those logs and products to be traded in an open market.
We have a minute, Holly. Did I say correctly that milling capacity is uneven throughout the country?
Yes, milling capacity definitely is uneven throughout the country.
And because of that, you have... Well, you emphasize the Vagan Brothers Lumber of Washington State have a 10-year contract, and what we need is more of those 10 and 20 and 30-year contracts. That would help the forest.
that would help the forest. And Vaughan Brothers has done some really, really interesting things. They have actually bid on a project where they helped pay for the NEPA because they realized that there was great value in the forest, and this was actually for some commercial timber harvest, and they were willing to help move this thing forward so they could actually tap into some of that. And they both have milling infrastructure for large diameter wood, and they also have milling infrastructure for small diameter wood that they've invested in as we're seeing more and more small diameter timbers come out of the forest.
Fix America's Forest Reforms to Restore National Forests and Tackle the Wildfire Crisis. Holly Fretwell, Jonathan Wood. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.